evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of American Exposé. Darren Weeks here with you on May 6th, 2005, as the year is just rapidly flying by and time continues to move forward. And people continue to be asleep to what's going on in the country. Although, frankly, folks, I think the ground is more fertile than it ever has been before as people see more and more government oppression. And this thing continues to spread. Family members are being killed over in the Middle East. The world order is being shaped. And the plan's coming into fruition. People are starting to see that things are happening. Things are coming together. The new world order of George Herbert Walker Bush spoke of is happening right before our very eyes. And before George Bush said that, of course, we were all a bunch of kooks for using that phrase. But then it's kind of hard to argue that it exists. It's kind of hard to say that it doesn't exist when you have the president on TV talking about it, you know. At any rate, I'm glad you're joining us tonight, folks. I'm going to be dealing with a little bit of energy, although I don't intend to limit it to that. Hopefully I can get through this whole piece because I got some other information to share with you as well. And maybe we'll get into a little bit of the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is called CAFTA. This thing is on the fast track for a vote, possibly as early as later on this month, folks. And they're really trying to rush this thing through. And so we need to know about it. And so it's our job in the alternative media to tell you just what it's going to do. Because the mainstream controlled media hasn't said a whole lot that I've heard about it. Maybe I just haven't heard it. But at any rate, without further ado, I want to get into this. There's an article in April 4th, 2005 edition of the New American. And by the way, I want to make sure that you understand, I do not issue the New American a blanket endorsement. They've written some good stuff, but I don't. It's really hard to issue a blanket endorsement of any organization. But they have an article. It's a front page cover called Our Energy Future, It May Be Brighter Than You Think. And it goes to confirm some of the things that Lindsey Williams has said when he's been on the broadcast. An article by Dennis Behrendt, I guess that's how you pronounce it. I probably butchered it. I apologize. But it says, energy's future. The world need never run out of energy. In fact, technology and private enterprise are poised to bring us an abundance of energy if government would just get out of the way. He says, it's hard to escape the conclusion that America faces a new and perhaps a serious energy crisis. Home heating costs have risen dramatically. The price at the gasoline pump is rising rapidly, and the price of crude oil is on the increase. The rising cost of fuel will affect consumers of all goods, as the cost of bringing those goods to market will rise in concert with the rise of the cost of fuel. At least for now, there does not appear to be any relief in sight, as demand for oil is expected to continue to grow. On March 11th, the Paris-based International Energy Agency, which is an arm, by the way, folks, of the United Nations, but they announced its latest forecast for energy demand. The agency expects that global consumption of oil will climb this year to 84.3 million barrels per day, a 2.2% increase over the previous year. Importantly, the world is not running out of oil. I want to say that again, folks. Importantly, the world is not running out of oil. The current crisis stems not from the depletion of the Earth's oil resources, but from the inability of current infrastructure to support the increased demand. This is what I told you last week on this broadcast. The IEA said, quote, the reality is that oil consumption has caught up with installed crude and refining capacity. It's refinery, folks. There's no oil shortage. It's a refinery shortage. And who limits refining building in this country but government? They continue, the International Energy Agency. They say, if supply continues to struggle to keep up, more policy attention may come to be directed at oil demand intensity in our economies and alternatives. Unquote. The IEA is partially correct, he says. More effort is needed to develop energy technologies whether that effort is within the fossil fuels industry or in advancements in alternative technologies. The answer, though, does not lie with more policy attention directed by governments at influencing market trends. In fact, government regulations are directly responsible for limiting our refinery capacity. If left alone, the market demand for energy will spur competition to invest in new infrastructure and new technologies. The current energy environment, marked by strong demand, will result in increased spending on exploration for new energy sources and on the new energy technologies. Similar crises in the past were alleviated through just this type of investment and innovation. If left unhampered by government, there is no telling what energy technologies will be achieved in the near future by innovators eager to supply the world's increasing appetite for energy. Then he goes into some history. He says, in many ways, the current energy environment bears similarities with an era that seems far removed from our current technological age. In the late Renaissance and early modern period, Europe underwent a technological revolution in energy and productivity. The early modern Europe that emerged from the Renaissance is often thought of in one of two distinct ways. For some, it is an era of the Reformation, when much thought and vitality went into constructing the theologies and denominations of Protestantism. For others, it was the age of exploration, when adventurers followed the path blazed by Columbus into the deep recesses of the Atlantic and then Pacific Oceans. It was also an era of great commercial expansion, and this commercial expansion was driven by energy. Prior to this period, the primary motive energy source in Europe was muscle power, either human or animal. For heating and cooking, wood played a primary role. Later, following the Renaissance, Europe's commercial success continued to expand, and with it, population expanded. Growth was sustained by energy. At sea, naval technology was increasingly able to harness the power of the wind, allowing European nations to engage in ever more vigorous trade with distant lands. Within Europe itself, forests provided plenty of wood for domestic energy needs, but demand eventually began to outstrip the ability of the existing infrastructure to bring energy to market, and costs rose. The agrarian regime encountered inherent limits that it could not transcend without a fundamental transformation of its social metabolic basis, wrote German historian Rolf Peter Seiferl. I'm sorry, I probably mispronounced that. He wrote that about the energy availability in the 1700s. Those observations speak for the fact that in the 18th century, the pre-industrial system stood at a threshold impeding the growth of important physical parameters, population size, material flow. The energy potential of the given area was, in a sense, exhausted, he said. The pre-industrial energy system was heavily dependent on wood. The rising demand for wood reduced the supply, causing prices to rise. Pundits rang the alarm bells about the soaring cost of wood for heating and for iron industry. The price of charcoal made from wood doubled in real terms between 1630 and 1700, writes business journalist V.J.V. Mathieswaren. I'm not sure I pronounced that right either, but in his recent book, Power to the People. The rise in prices spurred by the increased demand for energy led to the development of new and previously little used energy sources. Quote, enticed by rising prices, entrepreneurs rose to the occasion. They found a way to bring to market a substance that had been largely overlooked until then, coal. That was a turning point in history, for without coal there would have been no industrial revolution, wrote Mathieswaren. The Industrial Revolution may have seen the rise of all manner of innovation, but it was without a doubt built on the back of King Coal, which replaced wood as the most dominant energy source. Day by day, it becomes more evident that the coal we happily possess in excellent quality in abundance is the mainspring of modern material civilization, British economist William Stanley Jevons wrote in his book, The Coal Question, published in 1865. He says, as the source of fire, it is the source at once of mechanical motion and of chemical change. Accordingly, it is the chief agent in almost every improvement or discovery in the arts which the present age brings forth. Unquote. However, Jevons did not think that the rapid increase in coal production to support the present age was sustainable. He opined that England's rapacious appetite for energy would soon consume the nation's coal reserves. He says, quote, I draw the conclusion that I think anyone would draw, that we cannot long maintain our present rate of increase of consumption, that we can never advance to the higher amounts of consumption supposed, unquote. Now, in the end, Jevons thought England would run out of coal by 1900s. Jevons needn't have worried. As before, demand for energy made innovation worthwhile, and another form of fuel was brought to market. It was time to turn to crude oil. This fuel had been known for centuries. The Romans burned it as a fumigant. In Borneo, it had been used for heat and light. But as the 20th century drew near, this fuel would become the lifeblood of the world's economy. Early wells were shallow, limited by insufficient drilling technology. All that changed on January 10, 1901. Two brothers, Al and Kurt Hamill, using a rotary drill technology, bored through more than 1,000 feet of Texas soil on a small hill called Spindletop. Just when it seemed as if they should give up, the drill punctured a pressurized dome of fossil fuel. Methane gas came howling from the drill with a roar, followed by a geyser of oil. There was more oil than anyone had ever imagined. Most wells of the day were shallow and produced 50 to 100 barrels per day. Spindletop produced 100,000 barrels per day. A confluence of events was now occurring that would make oil the most important fuel of the world. The internal combustion engine would shortly become combined with a horseless carriage, and diesel and gasoline refined from crude oil would power the new transportation device. Coal had been used to power steam engines, but oil quickly became the fuel of choice for those too. Paul Roberts wrote in his recent book, The End of Oil, quote, as oil prices fell, coal users began switching in droves to the more efficient oil. Railroads converted their coal-fired locomotives to burn cheap Texas crude. Shipping companies, quickly recognizing that oil made their ships go faster, and also that it took up less storage room on board than coal did, refitted cargo vessels to run on oil. Unquote. Since Spindletop, oil had been king, and for a good part of the 20th century, the United States was both the top producer and consumer of oil. By 1946, however, the nation was actually consuming more oil than it produced, a condition that has persisted to the present. Since then, there's been an ever-present chorus of those claiming that the world is about to run out of oil. Ever since oil was first harvested in the 1800s, people have said we'd run out of the stuff, noted John Felmy, the chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute. These predictions have come to naught, says science journalist Kevin Keller. Quote, in the 1880s, a Standard Oil executive sold off shares in the company out of fear that its reserves were close to drying up, unquote, Keller wrote in the August 2004 issue of Popular Science. Similarly, in 1977, President Jimmy Carter warned that mankind, quote, could use up all of the proven oil reserves in the entire world by the end of the next decade, unquote. That, of course, wasn't true then, and it isn't true now. It is, of course, true that there is more demand for oil today from other quarters of the world than there was previously, whereas North America and Europe have been far and away the major consumers of energy throughout most of the last century. Now emerging industrialized economies in Asia, notably China, which we are building up by purchasing all of their products, folks. But they're competing for the resource. And yet the world is not running out of oil. There is, in fact, quite a large amount of oil remaining. In the U.S. alone, in 2003, according to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, proved reserves, meaning oil that can be recovered from existing reservoirs under current operational and economic conditions, totaled some 21.8 billion barrels. Worldwide in 2003, proved reserves totaled 1.15 trillion barrels, enough to last for 41 years, according to a giant oil firm, British Petroleum. Despite those who say we are about to run out of oil and gas, the figures in the review confirm there is no shortage of reserves, said BP chief economist Peter Davies. And he ought to know, folks, because he's the guy who works for the oil company. At the current rate of consumption, it appears that the world's proved reserves will be consumed in approximately 30 to 40 years. This, however, may not be likely. Proved reserves are only those reserves that are feasibly recoverable, both economically and technologically at a given time. As technology improves and demand increases, it will become practical to recover more oil, increasing proved reserves. In fact, this has happened in the past, and proved reserves figures have gone up. Now, folks, I want to say one thing about this. It says at the current rate of consumption, it appears that the world's proved reserves will be consumed in approximately 30 to 40 years. Well, we've already learned from Lindsey Williams that there have been a lot more oil wells. There have been a lot more oil fields that have been proven, that have been proved and classified. This information doesn't take into account the fact that there is classified, proven wells that have been discovered, reserves. There's a whole lot of oil that has been discovered and proven in Alaska's North Slope. And we've covered that in the past, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I just wanted to make sure that I pointed that out, because this article here doesn't take that into consideration. But they go on to explain that it says that they're talking about proved reserves, and proved reserves are only those reserves that are feasibly recoverable both economically and technologically at a given time. As technology improves and demand increases, it will become practical to recover more oil, increasing proved reserves. In fact, this has happened in the past, and proved reserves figures have gone up. The total amount of the resource available, though not necessarily accessible under current conditions, is vastly larger than proved reserves. According to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, technically recoverable resources of crude oil in the U.S. alone total 105.05 billion barrels, five times the proved reserves subset. It's worth considering, in addition, that many domestic resources have been placed off limits. And this is the key, folks. Many domestic resources have been placed off limits by government regulation. In fact, according to the EIA, 78.6% of technically recoverable resources are located on federal land. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, is a case in point. The ANWR sits upon vast amounts of recoverable oil on a par with the current largest U.S. oil field at Prudhoe Bay. The oil could be recovered with negligible impact to the environment of the area, yet opening the ANWR to drilling continues to be resisted. Similarly, much of the outer continental shelf of the nation's coast has been made off limits, despite the very real possibility that important energy resources may be located there. In addition, other deposits of oil and other substances in the contiguous states have been made off limits by virtue of the fact that they are located on federal land. The energy future, in fact, would be very bright if government would simply get out of the way and allow entrepreneurs to develop our known energy resources and discover new ones. Despite government interference, new technologies are constantly putting more oil within man's reach, probably much to the frustration of the global planners, because it hasn't always been possible to recover all the oil from an oil field. Some of the oil, sometimes large amounts, remained out of reach. Paul Roberts says, quote, as recently as the 1970s, drillers were lucky to extract 30% of the oil from a field, while effectively leaving 70% in the ground as unrecoverable, unquote. That may be changing. Studies have shown, for instance, that injecting carbon dioxide into depleted oil fields, or water, folks, allows for the recovery of additional oil, sometimes in substantial quantities. Other new techniques also may also improve access to oil. New seismic survey techniques allow scientists to pinpoint oil reserves with greater accuracy. New deep-sea drilling technologies are bringing offshore resources within reach. Intelligent well systems are giving operators and engineers more finely tuned control of wells. Even the drills themselves are improving. According to Popular Science, flexible coiled tube drills that carve out horizontal side pads are a marked improvement over conventional rigid drills that move only straight down. Using such technologies, companies hope to soon harvest 50-60% of the oil from existing wells, up from today's 35%. And by the way, folks, I don't know if they're going to cover this in this because I haven't read this whole article yet, but we covered an article on this program in the past week or two, where a lot of these wells are filling back up from below. So, I mean, just the amount of oil that happens to be there doesn't necessarily mean that's all that's going to be there, as these wells that they thought were depleted, they thought they were spent, they turned around and reversed themselves, and they were able to up the amount, the projected amount of oil that they were going to get from them by huge amounts. So we really have there's evidence that strongly suggests that the earth is awash in oil and that we have a limitless supply of it. But that's something that you're not going to hear from the controlled media, is it? Because that doesn't fit into the template of the agenda of the planners. Continuing, and that's why you listen to broadcasts on First Amendment Radio Network. Continuing here, they say, even though the technology will make it possible to continue to supply the world's oil needs, the increased demand for energy may make other fuels attractive. The United States sits atop an almost unimaginably vast store of relatively high-quality coal. As an energy source, coal is supposed to be passé. Widely regarded as a dirty substance that kills miners and pollutes the air with choking soot and poisonous sulfur dioxide, it was supposed to have been relegated to the dustbin of history by cleaner burning oil and natural gas. The coal is still vital. That coal is still vital is illustrated by the career of Corbin Robertson Jr. Robertson's family turned oil into a billion-dollar business with Quintana Petroleum. But the young Corbin gave it all up for coal. He says, I bet the ranch and all the cows on it. Robertson told Forbes magazine in 2003. He says, I even hocked the Tom O'Connor oil field. In fact, the attraction of coal is its sheer quantity. According to the National Mining Association in 2003, U.S. coal reserves stood at a staggering 496 billion tons. At present rates of consumption, these reserves will supply U.S. coal needs for more than 200 years. Coal is presently and will continue to be important to the U.S. energy supply. According to the Energy Information Agency, quote, coal is projected to fuel roughly 50% of electricity generation through 2025, unquote. Even so, coal prices are expected to hold steady or even decline over the same period, making it an even more attractive fuel option. Innovation may make coal even more essential. Coal can be turned into a gas. Many years ago, this gas was used to provide fuel for gas lights, but now some generating stations are being built that use the gas to generate electricity. Integrated gasification combines CYCO, or IGCC, power plants. First turn coal into gas, and then use the gas to power gas-fired turbines, making electricity. In the process, they produce CO2 that could be used in efforts to recover oil from depleted wells. And depleted, of course, being in quotes, because they're not really depleted. Moreover, the process of gasification produces hydrogen itself, an energy source with vast potential for the future. Finally, the procedure works with fuels other than coal. Under parts of Canada, for instance, are vast quantities of tar sands. The province of Alberta, for example, sits upon tar sands holding the equivalent of a trillion barrels of oil, fuel that can augment coal in IGCC plants. an otherwise difficult to harness fuel, heavy oil, and there are large concentrations in South America, can also be used by the process. Paul Roberts writes, he says, quote, a $1.2 billion IGCC plant in Italy, for example, turns 16 million tons of heavy oil into 550 megawatts of electricity and several tons of hydrogen, which could be used to run fuel cell cars. And folks, we got to take a break here. You're listening to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks. We're covering energy again tonight, folks. And this wasn't something I really planned to do. I planned to do something else, but energy is very important right now, as it always is. So stay with us. We're going to continue this on the other side of the break. American Exposé. Don't go away.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and following the instructions there to support us. Thank you for listening.
Dial 911 and Die, the book police chiefs and politicians don't want you to read, shows there is no legal obligation for the police to protect you. Just ask yourself, if the police aren't obligated to protect my family and I'm disarmed by legislation, what if...
A burglar!
Dial 911 and Die is available from Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Order it online at jpfo.org.
Be sure to listen to the Church at Kuia every Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. Pacific Time. The Church at Kuia is a Lordship Church under the sole authority of Jesus Christ. You may contact the Church at Kuia by calling 559-561-4860. That's 559-561-4860. And let them know how much you're being blessed. Thank you.
Love to use against us, and one of those weapons is the control of energy, and that's what we're covering tonight on the broadcast, as we have many times in the past. And we're going to move on to some other areas here as soon as I get through the rest of this article, folks. I got some information from the Nature Conservancy, by the way. They're poised to have a huge land grab in the state of Michigan, where I'm at. The Upper Peninsula, they've been swallowing land for years in Michigan. And by the way, folks, the Nature Conservancy website, you can go to their website at nature.org, www.nature.org. Folks, they have chapters. The Nature Conservancy, this land-grabbing, land-swallowing group, they have a chapter for every state in the Union. Every state in the Union, they're operating, and they're swallowing land. And they swallow the land, they absorb this, and they sell it to the government whenever the government gets around to buying it. Either that or they sell it to private individuals with conservation easements on it. So the development is strictly limited on the land that they purchase from the time that they purchase it until the time, well, forever, basically. This is forever. This is a zero-sum game, folks, and that's why we're so concerned about private property rights, is because future generation, what happens now is going to determine the destiny, the ability of the future generations to be able to develop and own private property. And I keep thinking about that article that we have on the Sweet Liberty website somewhere where they talk about, a former Secretary of Agriculture of the U.S. government said, his name was Tugwell, Rexford Tugwell. He made the statement that in the future, government will own all land. Government will control all land. And we can see that going on. So I intend to get into some of that tonight, as long as I don't ramble on too long now. And don't forget, Monday we're going to be covering CAFTA. The Central American Free Trade Agreement, very important stuff, as it's on the fast track to possibly be voted on right here in this month, the month of May. If not May, then probably early June. But they're talking late May right now, and Congress has been put on notice by the president. They want to fast track this thing, and they're going to try to push it through on the American people. We see the incredible good that NAFTA has done. NAFTA has done so much good for this country. Now since NAFTA has done such a great job for America, they're going to expand it now to the Central America Free Trade Agreement. Yeah, so I think we know the destiny. We know that the plan of the controllers. We know the traitors that we have occupying the Oval Office and Congress. And folks, one of those traitors, of course, is George W. Bush.
The economy, because our small business owners and families are paying higher prices at the gas pump.
That's right. That's President in his last presidential news conference. We're going to play the entire clip. We're all paying higher gas prices at the gas pump, and it's only going to get worse, and his energy policy isn't going to make it any better. So continuing with this information from Dennis Berendt, I guess is how you pronounce his name. Energy's future. The world never need run out of energy. In fact, technology, and if technology and private enterprise are poised to bring us an abundance of energy, if government will just get out of the way, they can do it successfully. Continuing here, he says, fuel cell powered cars may prove to be the most important technological innovation since the internal combustion engine. Currently, much of the oil recovered from the world's oil fields is refined into the fuels used by the internal combustion engine powering the world's fleet of cars and trucks. Naturally, the demand for oil for this purpose would be significantly diminished if fuel cell powered vehicles live up to their promise. There are, however, difficulties to be overcome. Fuel cells are deceptively simple. They work by combining hydrogen and oxygen to create water, producing electricity in the process. The only byproduct is water. Because the process is silent and results in electricity, automobile designers are presented with design possibilities never before attainable due to constraints imposed by the internal combustion engine and the gearing mechanisms needed to harness its power. Suddenly, completely silent automobiles featuring fly-by-wire controls become feasible. The chief problem with fuel cells is the fuel. Hydrogen is difficult to store and not easily accessible at present. Although hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, it is almost invariably found in combination with other elements and must be freed for use. This itself takes energy. Fortunately, this can be overcome by coal-fired IGCC power plants. Still, the infrastructure needed to store and distribute the hydrogen will be needed. Another operation will be to power fuel cells with more complex hydrocarbons, like methane, and reform them on board for use in the fuel cell. This less efficient method may be an intermediate solution. So are fuel cells just some futurist pipe dream? Based on the fact that they are being employed commercially, the answer must be no. General Motors, for instance, has entered into a deal with Dow Chemical to provide fuel cell technology to a Dow plant. According to a GM overview of the plan, the initial GM fuel cell will generate 75 kilowatts of power. This is enough electricity for 50 average homes. Dow and GM plan to ultimately install up to 400 fuel cells to generate 35 megawatts of electricity. That would be enough power for 25,000 average-sized American homes. Fuel cells aren't the only futuristic energy technology that will probably play a significant role in the near future. Another is a technology that has already been producing power for nearly 50 years, but still seems futuristic nonetheless, and that's nuclear energy. Prior to the nuclear age, splitting the atom was considered an impossibility. Albert Einstein, the famous physicist, argued, quote, "There is not the slightest indication that nuclear energy will ever be obtainable. It would mean that the atom would have to be shattered at will," unquote. Work completed by Enrico Fermi and others, though, caused Einstein to change his mind. Nuclear power and American innovation has been brought to a virtual standstill in this country because of political, not technological, obstacles, yet it is still a viable and important energy source. According to the Federal Energy Information Agency, U.S. nuclear facilities had a record year in 2004. The EIA reported, quote, "The U.S. nuclear industry generated 788,556 million kilowatt hours of electricity in 2004, a new U.S. and international record. Although no new U.S. nuclear power plants have come online since 1996, this is the industry's fifth annual record since 1998, unquote. There are currently 104 licensed nuclear power generating stations operating within the United States. The energy they produce accounts for about 20% of the nation's electricity and about 8% of the total energy we consume. These figures could be higher, as evidenced by the fact that many other nations, taking full advantage of the technology the United States developed, are using nuclear technology to produce a much higher percentage of their electricity from nuclear power than we are. Japan plans to increase its nuclear capacity so that 41% of its total energy needs can be met with atomic energy. What's more, despite setbacks, Japanese industry is committed to advancements in nuclear technology. Japan invested heavily in fast breeder technology, competing with Manju fast breeder reactor that would get dramatically more energy out of a given amount of uranium than the conventional nuclear power plant. The Manju reactor suffered a coolant leak and was shut down, but plans exist for bringing the facility back online soon. Nuclear energy may even play a role in smaller-scale remote installations. The town of Galena, Alaska, suffers from an erratic energy supply and wants to install a small Japanese-made nuclear reactor. The liquid sodium-cooled Toshiba-built reactor would produce 10 megawatts of electricity and would run almost unattended and underground. It would not need to be refueled for 30 years. Whether in small-town Alaska or in the lower 48 states, nuclear power can provide a relatively inexpensive, clean, and nearly unlimited source of energy. The future is not limited to the fossil fuels and nuclear fission of the past century. Just as the last 100 years have witnessed almost unimaginable advances in technology, the next 100 years will almost certainly be just as revolutionary. Quote, "Over the next few decades, we are very likely to see all kinds of technological advances that have nothing to do with hydrocarbons or solar or wind, for that matter, advances that most of us brought up in the age of oil probably can't even imagine," unquote. That was Paul Roberts in his book, The End of Oil. In the fall of 1984, two chemists, Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, suspended a solid palladium electrode measuring 1 cubic centimeter in a beaker filled with a mixture of deuterium and lithium. Inserting another electrode, they passed a current through the mixture, forcing the deuterium into the palladium. One evening that winter, the exact date is unclear, the experiment appeared to have come to a violent end. To Pons, it seemed as if there had been an explosion. The palladium block may have been vaporized, or parts of it becoming superheated, melted through the beaker. The table on which the beaker sat and spilling onto the floor below produced a hole 4 inches deep in the lab's concrete floor. Accounts of the accident differ, but it seemed as if something violently energetic might have occurred. The chemists became convinced that they had achieved the impossible, a fusion reaction at room temperature. Fusion is the reaction that powers the sun and all of the stars. If a fusion reaction occurred in the lab that night, as Pons and Fleischmann suspected, it would mean a future of limitless cheap energy. After a series of further experiments, the cold fusion duo went public March 23, 1989, to a chorus of worldwide acclaim and wonder. In the end, attempts to duplicate the results proved fruitless. Cold fusion had not been achieved. Nevertheless, it is just this pioneering spirit that will likely usher in further advancements in energy technology. And fusion itself is not dead. Experiments with hot fusion, both in tokamak, or magnetic reactors, and with inertial or laser-powered technologies, could still bring the power of the sun to Earth. But even the power of fusion would pale before the possibilities of another exotic futuristic power, antimatter. The material that powers the fictional Starship Enterprise on TV was actually first predicted based on work done in 1928 by physicist Paul Dirac. Though it had been the stuff of science fiction for years, antimatter really does exist. Antimatter essentially the same as regular matter. The only difference is its charge is reversed. A normal, positively charged proton, for instance, finds its antimatter counterpart in a negatively charged antiproton. Similarly, the normal, negatively charged electron's antimatter counterpart is the positron. The existence of the positron was discovered in 1932. That's a long time ago, folks. And I'm sure they've been working with us all this year. And the question here I have is, how much of this stuff have they really developed that they're not telling us about? I mean, for instance, can they really use cold fusion? You know, but they're not telling us about it. Antimatter has immense potential for energy generation. Should a particle of antimatter encounter a particle of ordinary matter? The result is the complete annihilation of both particles and their complete conversion into energy. According to a senior science writer, Robert Roy Britt of Space.com, quote, a solar flare in July 2002 created about a pound of antimatter, or a half a kilo, according to a new NASA-led research. That's enough to power the United States for two days. The entire United States for 2 days. So far, only small amounts of antimatter can be made in the lab using incredibly high energy particle accelerators. Still, there's no telling what these advances and others yet unimagined may bring. One thing is certain, though, the current energy crisis, and I'll put that word in quotes, marked by the rapidly rising cost of petroleum will be like other such crises in the past. It will not be an indication that a resource is being depleted because, like wood and coal of earlier days, oil continues to exist in abundance. The rising cost does mean, though, that vast opportunities exist for innovators and investors who seek to bring new technologies to market. The risks are high, but the rewards are great. If the past is a guide, the current robust demand for energy will lead to a new age of energy innovation and abundance. In other words, folks, the future isn't as dark and dire as the globalist controllers would like you to believe, but they'll do everything they can to screw it up. They'll do everything they can to get in the way of progress. Thank God their plans have been repeatedly foiled, however. Continuing on here, I want to cover this Nature Conservancy situation, and I realize this is an abrupt corner to turn. But I came across this piece quite by accident, and I just want to share this with you folks. This is directly from the Nature Conservancy's own website. Again, as I said a moment ago, nature.org, they have a chapter for every state in the union. And this particular piece is called, it's headlined, The Nature Conservancy Launches Biggest Conservation Campaign in State History. And we're talking about Michigan right now, although you can go to their website and find out what they're doing in your state, because they're doing something in your state. You can believe it. It says, group announces $70 million goal to protect Michigan's last great places. 35th annual Earth Day celebration comes early. And this is dated April 19, 2005. Dateline Lansing, Michigan. Leaders and supporters of the Nature Conservancy today announced a plan to protect Michigan's most ecologically sensitive areas by raising an unprecedented $78 million by the end of 2006. Stephen J. McCormick, president and CEO of the Nature Conservancy worldwide, says, quote, "Today, a new vision is taking root in Michigan." He says, "Increasingly, we are working on a larger scale because we recognize that small steps in piecemeal conservation isn't going to be enough to protect our natural heritage for future generations." What he should have said is, "Protect it from future generations." He continued, though. He says, "When the Michigan chapter's campaign for conservation is complete, we will have protected four times what we have conserved in Michigan since the Nature Conservancy started working here in 1960. I want to say that one more time. He says, "When the Michigan chapter's campaign for conservation is complete," and he's talking about this latest campaign, he says, "we will have protected four times what we have conserved in Michigan since the Nature Conservancy started working here in 1960. That's a lot of land that they intend to swallow up, folks. More than $68 million has been raised to date, leaving $10 million to be raised from private individuals and philanthropic organizations. The funding will help protect priority landscapes across the state, from the Detroit River to the Saugatuck Dunes, to the tip of the Kanawha Peninsula. McCormick and the Nature Conservancy is building on its recent success, protecting more than 271,000 acres. Folks, it says they're building on their recent success, protecting. And remember who they're protecting it from. They're protecting it from you and your children and your grandchildren for future generations to come. Forever. They're building on their success of, quote-unquote, protecting more than 271,000 acres in the Upper Peninsula. That's 423 square miles, folks. A project announced earlier this year with Governor Jennifer Granholm. The project ensures permanent public access for recreational activities such as hiking, canoeing, fishing, hunting, and snowmobiling along designated trails, and allows sustainable timber harvesting. And an estimated 3,000 forest-related jobs will be protected by allowing continued outdoor recreation and forestry on the land. See, you're going to be able to go on your eco-tours. You're going to be crammed in sustainable cities in the future, folks, if they get their way. And you're going to be able to go on your eco-tours and walk through designated trails and experience nature. And that's going to be the extent of it. You're not going to be able to have your little house in the country anymore. You're not going to be able to have a place on the lake. You're not going to be able to have all this stuff that you have now, away from people, out, so you can enjoy nature on your own terms. You're gonna enjoy nature on the terms that they define for you, because they will control all of the land if they are not stopped. Michigan's leading foundations are helping fund the project by committing $31.5 million. The Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund has also contributed significant funding, and federal appropriations for the project are now pending before Congress. Because Michigan holds a unique place at the center of the Great Lakes ecosystem, the work of the Nature Conservancy is incredibly important not only to the future of our state, but for our region as well, said Peter Weege of the Weege Foundation. He says, "We live in the heart of the world's largest freshwater resource. Everything we do that produces adverse effects compromises the entire system. The Frey Foundation believes that protecting the natural environment is essential to the quality of life," said Milt Rower, president of the Frey Foundation. Quote, "For this reason, we place a major emphasis on land protection. We encourage environmental preservation and seek to maintain a balance between open land and well-planned development in our target communities of western Michigan. The Nature Conservancy works well to maintain that balance, and we are proud to be a strong supporter of their work." Unquote. The Nature Conservancy prioritizes landscapes for protection based on an eco-regional process analyzing threats, strategies, partnership opportunities, and impact on biological diversity, or biodiversity. The campaign will focus on the most vulnerable forest, water, and shoreline priorities across the state. Philip H. Power, who's on the Board of Trustees. He's chair for the Nature Conservancy in Michigan. He says, quote, "You cannot put a price on a natural, on our natural resources, nor the effort needed to protect them. But we can prioritize through science and understanding what is most vulnerable now." Unquote. DTE Energy Foundation will commit $500,000 to the campaign for conservation in Michigan, and DTE Energy will provide about $2 million in additional funding for a major reforestation project on Louisiana's famous Cat Island, one of the last known locations of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And of course, why is DTE doing that? Probably to throw them a bone. To get them to leave them alone. That would be my guess. Gerald M. Anderson, president of DTE Energy, said, quote, "DTE Energy recognizes its unique position at the intersection of economic and environmental progress." That's corporate claptrap for saying, we just want them to leave us alone. He says, "We have worked with the Nature Conservancy for more than two decades to preserve some of our last great places for future generations, and I encourage the corporate community to join me, in committing to this campaign and to protecting the forests and waters that define our great state." Unquote. The campaign will also benefit locations from Brazil to the Bahamas, which serve as winter habitat for the Kirtland's warbler, an endangered bird that nests in the Jack Pine Forest of Michigan's northern lower peninsula. You know, the funny thing about this, I think it's interesting, the more preservation that goes on here, the more endangered species that we have. Isn't that interesting? It's just like the war on terror. I mean, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on crime. You know, everything that the government declares war on, you get more of, right? Seems like since these conservation groups have been protecting so many things, we've never had more endangered species than we have now. I don't know. Am I loony? Or am I just missing something here? The mission of the nature... Folks, what it boils down to is they need the crisis in order to bring about control. Are there really this many endangered species? And if so, who's endangering them? Because human beings have lived alongside ecology since the beginning of time. Since the beginning of creation. Yeah, sure, we've had some endangered and extinct species, but folks, have we ever had as many as we have now? At least according to what these people say. They say the mission of the Nature Conservancy is to preserve the plants, animals, and natural communities that present the diversity of life on Earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. The Nature Conservancy counts at least 1 million members worldwide, including 30,000 in Michigan, many of whom are attracted by the Conservancy's non-confrontational, market-based approach for accomplishing its science-driven mission. And they say, for more information, visit nature.org/Michigan. But folks, you can visit nature.org/your state, and it'll take you... I know for a fact, if you go to nature.org and look around on there, you'll find your state listed, because I found a page that has every state of the union. Every state of the union. In fact, I'll tell you where it is. You go to www.nature.org/where we work, all together, no spaces, nature.org/where we work, all together, /North America, again, one word, there's no spaces in any of this, /states, and you'll find on the left-hand side of that page the entire list of every single, there's a link to every state. Again, it's nature.org/where we work/North America/states. And you can find out what the Nature Conservancy is doing in your state and take action, some kind of action, to try to stop it. Now, I don't know what can be done legislatively to stop this group, because, frankly, they're a private organization, and I don't know how private organizations can be restricted from buying land. But that's precisely why they do this, is because these public-private partnerships help get the job done, because government could be stopped, but when you have a private enterprise like the Nature Conservancy buying up all this land, and I guess the biggest thing is to educate people as to the dangers that this thing is going on, because and why not to give to these groups. These groups have a lot of funding, and it takes money in order to be able to buy all this land. And well-meaning people see their public service announcements on TV and hear them on the radio, and they think, oh, that sounds really nice, you know, conserving land. I like nature. I like to go camping. I like to do things in the forest. And so they'll give to this group without even realizing that in reality what they're doing is they're cutting their own throat, and they're cutting the throats of generations to come. But folks, we're out of time. We got to go. I appreciate you joining me. And join me Monday as we cover the CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which will be the stepping stone to the free trade area of the Americas. Thanks for being with us. God bless you. And have a good weekend, folks. Do something and enjoy yourself. God bless. Good night.
That's the sound of nearly 3 million American jobs being flushed down the toilet. What caused it? NAFTA. 10 years ago, Congress passed NAFTA. It was supposed to boost our economy. Instead, we lost millions of jobs and the nation is still hurting. But now Congress is quietly considering doing it again. But worse this time. By